The book is actually called Soldiers of Empire, Indian and British Armies in World War II, and it's coming out in May on CUP, and that's the cover photo, which is inviting you inside with both an open and a wry smile, which I quite like those two dudes. That's a section of colonial infantry of 27th Rajput in the Arakan in Burma, preparing to go out on patrol against the Imperial Japanese Army at the height of the campaign in Burma. What might be the significance of this section of colonial infantry from the mid-20th century, late in the era of the World Wars? Let me situate the book for you. It's a post-colonial military history and sociology. I'm not here as a South Asianist, I'm not one. If you can believe it, I was actually trained as a political scientist. I sinned very badly in a past life. But my focus is with this book is on someone who thinks about the international and imperial dimensions of the organization and use of military power in world politics. There's a tendency to imagine the political military aspects of world politics in terms of nation states. Each state a sovereign and territorial monopoly on legitimate force that constitutes military power nationally and projects it outward. So we have a lingo, you know, the US Army, the British Army, the German Army, which connects army and nation and state. In fact, an ordinary feature of world politics is the transnational and international constitution of force, the raising of troops from and other forms of military power in imperial and hierarchical contexts. For example, the training of Iraqi and Afghan forces by invading powers in the first decades of the 21st century. Much of the study of military history, military sociology, war and society scholarship, security studies more generally, has proceeded by assuming a nation-state ontology of the world, and does so in ways that we've come to recognize as Eurocentric. By Eurocentric here, I'm not referring to the need to recover subaltern studies, non-Western histories, that kind of thing. We do now have a good set of social histories on colonial armed forces. I'm referring more to the way in which general approaches and theories, questions, debates, and historiographies concerned with the political military have proceeded by taking as normal a world of nation states, a lateral, horizontal, or anarchic, if you know IR, world of competing powers with borders, all modeled on an image of the Western nation state and its ideal typical formation, in which a national army plays a big role. Nowhere is this more true than in debates over how soldiers are made and why they fight. Scholarship focuses almost exclusively on the national armies of the major Western powers, with particular emphasis on the US and Germany. So what the book seeks to do is revisit these questions and the debates over them, how soldiers are made and why they fight, by taking as ordinary an imperial multicultural army in which no one was working in their primary language, an army that was divided and ruled through colonial ethnicity. How might we reapproach some of the basic questions about military organization and combat motivation outside of, if also in critical dialogue with, the nation state, hence Indian and British armies in World War II. In this context, it's worth pointing out that the 27 Rajput, a designation that refers to a battalion of about 800 or 1,000 soldiers, was part of a 2.5 million strong British Indian Army during World War II, which fought nearly everywhere the Allies fought, bar France and Northern Europe, while policing Quit India at home and carrying the main burden of Britain's infantry war against Japan, mostly in Burma. Colonial armies such as French West African and North African forces, Koreans and Japanese service, Filipinos and US service, East and West Africans and British service, these were significant in raw military terms. Even during the world wars with their million-man armies. But the more fundamental world historical significance of colonial armed forces, as it were, was to expand and secure European imperial rule. European empires are unimaginable absent foreign military manpower. European expansion generated more or less continuous resistance abroad, while opponents of empire at home cited its cost in blood and treasure. In the academy, we tend to study the globalized, interconnected world made and maintained by Western empires as if it occurred almost wholly in the realms of the political, economic, and the cultural, with some politics thrown in. But empires were made and held by the sword, and the arm holding it was most often brown or black. Thus, the question of how soldiers are made and why they fight takes on some significance beyond critiquing Eurocentric military sociology. 2-7 Rajput here did its bit to secure Anglo-American liberal modernity. How was that possible? Why did they do it? What does it tell us about that ultimate form of political power, armed force? Let me make two other kind of preliminary points to stick in your heads before I go on. I first want to call up for you one important dimension of how the regular, drilled, and disciplined military appears in scholarship as a special property of Western modernity rooted in Greco-Roman heritage. The regular military on this view is one of those things that diffused from metropole to colony. It is certainly the case that particular European military forms traveled abroad to the colonies and shaped post-colonial militaries. But what I want to point out here is that in the diffusion story, military discipline, which is a set of ritualized practices and pedagogies discovered in many different times and places, military discipline somehow comes to underwrite the binaries of West Orient and modernity tradition. What I argue in the book is that the army in fact destabilizes them. The army is ancient and cosmopolitan, its discipline at home anywhere in the world. Its ideal-typical motive forces derive from ritual, cycles of blood debt, and the harsh circumstances of the battlefield. The army is not essentially modern or Western in the first instance as a social form. Drill and organized warfare are ubiquitous in world history. Second point I want to make, and just pulling out a little bit, another thing people do is study soldiers without paying attention to weapons. And it's a convention of, without being boyzone about it, there's a convention of British official military photographers in World War II to always capture in the frame these three weapons: the Lee Enfield rifle with the bayonet attached, the light machine gun or light automatic. This one is a Bren. You'll see another one in a little while. And here, a submachine gun, in this case, a US-made Thompson. It's much preferred over the British Sten because it would stop people. It was much more reliable. Now, most, if you throw in a grenade, an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, and a mortar, you have the basic suite of infantry weapons that still account for most of the fighting in world politics. People who study security studies, who pay attention to war, tend to focus on the high tech, the most advanced weapons, on air power, on drones, and ignore one of the great continuities of organized warfare in world history, which is bodies of troops trading casualties with basic infantry weapons. And that's something of that perspective is what I want to begin to get back with a post-colonial take on military history and military sociology. Okay, let's go on then to... It'll work. Oh.
Sorry, don't worry about it.
Well, as I'm sure it'll be no surprise to you, when you think about the Indian Army, the first thing you think about, of course, is the martial races. Known by the time of the World Wars as the martial classes, in a nice kind of example of T. Fujitani's polite racism for imperial military mobilization in the World Wars. Martial races arise, of course, from the Orientalist idea that most Asian men were effeminate and unsuited for military service, unlike in the West where anyone could be made into a soldier. In the Orient, only certain races, bred in specific climactic, geographical, or cultural circumstances, were suited to military service. So this doctrine held. Now, as you listen to me over the first slide, you might have been thinking, but of course we know why soldiers fight. They fight for their buddies. And indeed, if we stipulate that those are buddies who are already soldierized, transformed into soldiers, there is a great deal to this thesis. But we all don't go out of an evening with our friends and fight for our lives while killing others, although maybe sometimes. Group solidarity among soldiers is a crucial and necessary aspect of organized warfare, but it's not the whole story. In military sociology, solidary groups of soldiers are called primary groups. A basic problem with relying on the notion of primary groups to explain combat motivation is that group solidarity is essential both to vigorous obedience to orders and to vigorous collective refusal to obey orders. That is to say that mutiny also requires solidarity. And so what military sociologists have argued is that you need something to point the group in the right direction, toward the enemy. Moreover, the notion of buddies doesn't seem to account for particularly intense combat where comrades are rapidly killed off, or for combat that involves, as it did in Burma, a great deal of what you might call extracurricular violence, refusing to take prisoners, abuse and torture of enemy you do capture, and other kinds of atrocity. In search of answers to these problems, and given that they were studying national armed forces, scholars turned to the nation, to national culture, to national political ideology, to national racisms, to debate and supplement primary group theory, and underwrite and account for the cohesion evident in many of the great national armies of the modern era. So a kind of military sociological common sense emerged. It's primary groups and how good an army is at creating and sustaining them, plus nationalism or national politics that explains and accounts for soldiers. Now, I wouldn't suggest that this is a bad way to go or that it's wrong for every question that we might want to ask. It's very useful, but it also generalizes European national experience. It's provincial in Chakrabarty's specific meaning of the phrase. Obviously, this is not a national army in which national society is underwriting group solidarity and will to combat. The Raj used its great distinctions of caste, religion, and region after 1857 to divide and rule an Indian army of martial races so that it didn't combine and throw out the British. Nation and national culture were not unifying forces.
Could you just tell me, is Gurung a Gurkha?
Yes, it'd be a type of Gurkha. But the British Indian Army, despite not being a national army, despite being composed of peasants who were illiterate until they joined the forces, many of whom, of course, never would have heard of Japan, they fight the Japanese much like everyone else does, in intense, merciless, and very cruel ways. And in ways that don't, in which neither side is taking or accepting prisoners. Now, martial races don't just exist out there in reality in colonial society waiting to join the army fully formed. They are products of British and Indian imagination and effects of colonial knowledges and disciplinary practices. The martial races or classes had to be created, constructed in and through military discipline by regulating organization, discipline, diet, uniform, the observance of religion, living arrangements, and so on, according to the particular class characters of each class of troops. Now, one of the framings of conventional military sociology is the notion that soldiers get their qualities from a combination of national society or military, as I was saying. And they ask this in a kind of fashion that essentializes both society and the military. Is it more of what they brought from society into the military that explains what they do, or is it something that the military did to them? In looking at the way that the martial races are kind of constituted out of Indian society by military discipline, you get instead a kind of co-constitutive account of how it is that soldiers are produced and how militaries produce soldiers out of making use of a variety of social and cultural resources in the context from which they're raising troops. All right. Let's see if this will work this time. No, that's okay. Now, of course, one of the things that the British did to operationalize this idea of martial races is produce handbooks for officers. And the handbooks kind of combine the military manual with colonial anthropology in a kind of utile form where you could apply this knowledge. And one of the things that they tell you is what the typical physique and comportment and dress of each martial class was. In this way, the British officer could recognize the real deal, a real Pathan or Sikh or Dogra, as it were, while the Indian recruit needed only a few iterations of this process to figure out how he should present himself, comport himself, conduct himself.
I can see this.
There we go. Now we're working. So here, again, you can see if you're in this business of producing each class of troops as a distinct ethno-military formation, one of the things you do is you give them a separate mess and their own diet. Here are Pathan soldiers in training. Now, the stereotypes of the martial races were realized through disciplinary power, shaping recruits in a manner of a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Sikhs who trim their hair or beads, for example, risk discharge from the army. The five visible signs of faith for the Sikhs, hair, white underpants, the bangle, etc., were made important attributes of being a disciplined soldier. A wartime British officer wrote home of training Sikh troops in 1942, quote, "The Sikhs have many religious customs. We see that they keep them whether they like it or not." When queried on whether the troops must wear their civil bangles, his battalion commander had insisted, "Of course they must wear it. It's part of their religion."
The new battery.
You get your own, each company, or if you had two Muslim companies in the battalion, you'd have a Molvi for them. All to keep the army divided and ruled. So instead of unifying the army so to fight its enemies, all of Western military sociology, you're busy dividing the army. Now, the situation in the Indian Army is even, you can see how in uniform items, particularly with turbans, they've made distinctions. Now, the situation is even more crazy than I'm kind of letting on so far. I mentioned that the 27 Rajput from that first slide was a battalion of about 100, 1,000 troops. And this is a kind of archetype military formation because it's the largest military formation that can be commanded by voice command, as it still is on a parade ground today. Now, in a Western army, you would call each company in a battalion about 150, 200 troops. You'd call each one A company, B company, C company. And it would go without question that they would have a common language, they would have some sort of common basis in civil society. Not so in the Indian Army. In the Indian Army, the battalions were organized on a class company basis, so that each battalion would have maybe four different classes of troops: a Pathan company, a Sikh company, a Punjabi Muslim company, a Dogra company. So these ethnic divisions would go right down to the company level. And each company would have its own vernacular, overlaid by a dialect, Urdu or Hindustani, as the language of command. And then, of course, the British officers speaking English, who then would learn Urdu once they joined the army.
So there was one language for the whole company.
There is a language of command that is for the whole army, which is Urdu.
Regardless of whether they home languages were Urdu.
Exactly.
Or Hindi.
Regardless, everyone had to learn that language. It would be Gurkhali in Gurkha regiments. So no one is functioning in their primary language. This is a very strange military organization.
Well, I don't know. Throughout India.
Sorry.
Everybody has to operate in another language.
Absolutely. But what does it tell us about what we know, what we think we know about armies and their dependence on the nation? Okay, let me catch up with my notes here a little bit. So, you know, the Indian Army is not an elite shock force. It has its problems, but the thing works. It works against the Japanese, it works against the Germans, it functions. So how is it we have to alter what we think we know about armies and how we study them on this basis? And here, of course, is one of the consequences of this sort of Tower of Babel that I've described. All colonial armies have this kind of intermediate class of warrant officers who are usually the people who are responsible for discipline and the immediate arrangements with the soldiers. These are Sikh VCOs at a recruiting festival in 1944. They're the characters who enforce class discipline, and they're promoted out of the particular class that they join. So they're, as it were, advocates for their class in the battalion. As one Indian officer, an Indian commissioned officer, put it, "The old Indian Army was always meticulous in preserving orthodoxies and taboos. British officers never in any way tried to emancipate the men from their religious inhibitions." So this is an army that people are consciously setting out to divide. Now, Marshal Race's discourse, of course, often seems self-evidently true to many British officers because they could see with their own eyes an army organized in its image, a panoply of ethnic soldiers. Their soldiers were bred to be naturally warlike, if in need of leadership. Young officers were inculcated in the martial races. They came to govern the military class system in accordance with the class prejudices of the regiments they joined. Eric Stokes, later, I don't need to tell you who he is, or this audience, he'd been in the country less than a year as an officer cadet and subaltern of Indian Mountain Artillery when he wrote home to his sister that his regiment took only, quote, the pick of Indian troops, in this case Sikhs and Punjabi Muslims. Quote, the former are definitely more clever, but the Punjabis are easily the most lovable, unquote. The clever, scheming Sikh was by then a stock martial races trope. Serving later with Ahirs, a class recruited in wartime and not normally considered martial, Stokes describes them as, quote, not soldiers by instinct. Indian soldiers were viewed as dependent and childlike. Quote, there's probably no finer training and responsibility than to command Indian troops. He hadn't got to Cambridge yet. Because like a teacher at school, they look to you so utterly for their welfare and happiness. New to India, Stokes had rapidly acquired a working familiarity with the martial races and colonial discourse, making sense of his experiences through them. Later, stuck in a reinforcement camp awaiting deployment to Burma, which never quite actually reached, the war ended, Stokes was given various responsibilities over soldiers waiting for their assignments. In one affair, a Muslim Havildar sergeant charged with maintaining sanitary standards in the camp's kitchens inspected a cookhouse used by Gurkhas, who were Hindu. The old religious trouble flared up in the section today, wrote the young Stokes. To a Gurkha, who is a strong Hindu, a Muslim is almost the devil himself. You know, Gurkhas and Muslim instructors were working together throughout the army, right, being trained by one another. But nonetheless, you get this kind of, you know, it's a matter of religious bigotry among natives is the stock explanation that Stokes goes to about what happened. Now, as Christopher Bailey, who studied under Stokes, noted, he thought that Stokes' experiences in India had convinced him that castes and religions were concrete and sharply defined units, an idea that informed Stokes' scholarship until he encountered Edmund Leach and Stanley Tambiah in the 1970s. This is testament to the Indian Army's powers of constructing and naturalizing different ethnic groups. In the Army, the classes literally took form as distinct units. Ethnicity was a primary medium for everyday interaction between soldiers and a constitutive medium for the expression of the frustrations of military life. With Stokes, I've put in the last piece of the Indian Army. I like this picture because I think it sort of shows you the disciplinary mechanism of the Indian Army in operation. There's the British officer, super young in World War II. There'd be schoolboys sent to India and emergency commissioned. This is the VCO, you know, doing translating here to make sure that everyone understands what's being said. And these are two NCOs getting instructions for a deployment of some kind, and the photographer has obviously staged this. Now, one of the great myths of the Indian Army in memoirs, military histories, is in the self-image of its officer corps, was that British officers knew, at least in Orientalist terms, the languages and customs of their troops. But even among the pre-war regular officer corps, linguistic competence was spotty and regularly bemoaned in the pages of service journals. While their cultural knowledge generally amounted to simplistic stereotypes that aren't really worth the name colonial knowledge, right? The Pathans are touchy about their honor, that kind of thing. The wartime expansion of the army, which drew in thousands of emergency commissioned British officers, the officers who actually commanded Indian soldiers in combat in World War II, had little time to learn languages and culture. Basic Urdu along with English had to suffice. And of course, one consequence of this is that the only people who know every language in the unit are these guys, are the VCOs. And there are many wonderful stories of how British officers thought they knew what was going on in their battalion, but did not, in fact, know what was going on in their battalion. Quote, I mean, the British-speaking Hindustani was always rather a joke, commented one Indian interwar officer. Another officer complained in the service general that only a very low standard was necessary to pass the language exams. Ralph Russell, a wartime officer, later of course became an Urdu scholar, commented of his initial encounter with Indian Army language instruction, I was really keen to learn Urdu. But within a couple of weeks I had reluctantly given up because the officer instructing us didn't seem to know the language, especially the pronunciation. Well, and I knew that I should find it very difficult to unlearn incorrect pronunciation. Of his fellow British officer students, Russell noted that most of them were, quote, unenthusiastic about learning the language and didn't see why they should waste their time and effort on this inferior language. In the headquarters of his Chindit Brigade in Burma during the war, Michael Calvert faced even greater linguistic complexity. At one point, working with seven different groups, British, Indian, Burmese, Karen, Chinese, West African, and Gurkha. "I now know why cosmopolitan races gesticulate," he comments, after describing a situation in which he gave orders for a troop movement by charades. "To that lone tree on the hill, and I would look forlorn and lonely. There is your objective, and I would make motions to dig in madly." Despite linguistic incomprehension, the army functioned. Surprisingly, fluency was not necessary for effective infantry operations of the kind conducted in Burma. One reason why is found in Calvert's charades. Although infantry combat by the Second World War was a complex art, potentially involving many different weapon systems, the basic tasks which were given to any group of soldiers to perform were few in number and inculcated by training. Officers provided the intellectual oversight necessary for operations, orders to cover a given arc, to patrol an area, hold fire, and so on, were simple to communicate. As Calvert noted, every soldier in the British Empire understands the same words of command. And in this, it's not different than much different from the Roman Imperial Army, which also used an overlay language, Latin, as a language of command of troops that were from many, many different places. In the Korean War, U.S. Army decided that a vocabulary of around 100 words was all that was needed to allow U.S. and Korean soldiers to serve together at the platoon level. Okay. See here now, having created this edifice of Victorian difference with all these different uniform items and everything, they then get in the problem of actually having to administer and run this army at war in World War II, and they start simplifying things. And for me, this picture symbolizes the kind of modernized expedience implemented amid the pressures of World War II to overcome and simplify the overly complex structure of the army. So here's a cap to replace various kinds of pugris. Now, as you can imagine, running an army like this, supplying all the different kinds of foods, and especially, and this is something a little bit specific to militaries, but worth noting, one of the big problems in keeping a military fighting is being able to feed replacements into units in the line in a reasonable way. I won't describe what all the kinds of problems are with this. If you know you have a platoon company and it just so happens that one afternoon half of them are wiped out, that brigade in that particular place has to have the requisite number of platoon replacements. It has to have the NCOs who speak the Pashto and are able to command them, i.e. junior leaders, right? Maintaining this thing in the field was very difficult. So in some ways, it was sort of keeping the ethnic difference going was more of a problem than keeping the army fighting. One of the things they had to start doing is mix up troops in different companies, which I'll say something about in a minute. It was not essential, it turned out, to segregate the classes in the army because of the communal bigotry of Indian populations. Indian soldiers turned out to be more interchangeable than was thought the case. So during the Burma campaign, a common and potentially serious problem was that of providing correct and preferred rations to the different classes of troops. There were 30 different scales of rations that had to be supplied to 14th Army in difficult remote terrain. The right rations had to be gotten to the right troops amongst the various British, Indian, and African formations, and there was no cold transport or refrigeration facilities beyond Calcutta. So for British troops, of course, what you did is you pulled out your tin of bully beef, which may be very monotonous and disgusting, but you didn't suffer for protein. For Indian soldiers, the situation was much more severe. Sheep and goats were the usual source of meat in the Indian Army, but they did not travel well in conditions on the Assam front and died in large numbers. The supply situation for meat substitutes, milk and ghee, was of course worse because no refrigeration. And Indian troops then went at times for months without fresh meat, which is a big deal when you're in the heavily physically demanding situation of an infantry unit at war. Only belatedly did the Indian Army develop tinned rations of halal and jitka meat, ritually sanctioned equivalents to the British soldiers' bully. Many officers knew that Indian soldiers would eat what was available if the need was sufficiently dire or the temptation great, even in respect of pork and beef. As David Amissi observed of Indian soldiers in the First World War, while the Raj made sure its soldiers fighting abroad received culturally appropriate food, the soldiers themselves seemed to have become less fastidious as the war went on. Beyond cultural preferences and religious taboos, changing soldiers' diets was risky in disciplinary terms. Food evoked strong feelings. It could turn into a source of complaint and discontent, or be stoked into one by a minority. No habit is so beset by prejudice as that of eating, cautioned one training memo. But even British troops could be made to change their ways. Quote, British stomachs can digest Indian-style food, provided the introduction is deliberate and gradual. Officers often deceive troops to get them to eat what was available. For protein for the 819th Hyderabad in Burma, Lieutenant Colonel Timia had available at one point only pork and beef kidney soup, and so offensive to both his Muslim and Hindu troops. It seemed incredible that anyone could be so ignorant as to order such food for Indians, yet tons of it were everywhere. The kidney soup had not been so much ordered as provided by the United States in a self-heating ration tin. Worried about his soldiers' health, Timia billed the food as something special from America and dwelled on the novelty of the tin's heating mechanism and the tastiness of its contents to convince a small cadre from his battalion to try the new food. They then introduced it to the others, and soon the troops were eating quantities of the stuff. His game is nearly undone by a version of Eric Stokes' sanitary havildar, an Indian commissioned officer inspecting messing arrangements. One look and I recognize the officious type of high caste Hindu who would be horrified by the soup. He would spill the beans on my deception. Timia raised the false alarm of a Japanese attack and had the officer in a jeep on his way back to divisional headquarters before he could figure it out. It was a close call. Some of Timia's troops, and certainly VCOs who had English, might have well seen through the kidney soup sham or read the labels. But what Timia had done was to provide a public narrative by which his soldiers, Muslim, Sikh, and Hindu, could accept the needed nourishment. The problem wasn't the troops having irrational religious preferences about food, but the Indian Army's policy of creating and maintaining ethnic difference amongst its troops, and so empowering characters like the officer that Timia dealt with. In another kind of incidence of this kind, 14th Army at one point had a large quantity of dried whale meat. And some of the rules lawyers amongst the troops said, well, a whale is a mammal. Was it killed, ritually? Was it killed properly, halal? And so the British go back to the Grand Mufti in Cairo, and they get a dispensation that for purposes of eating, a whale can be regarded as a fish, And there again is the kind of public narrative that allows people to eat the food that they have available. There's sort of tons and tons of this kind of story. Go to about 3 o'clock is?
Yep.
Yeah? Let's see if I can cut a little off. I've got to bring this down a little bit.
Well, we have until 3:30.
Until 3:30, okay. So I want to now talk just a little bit about this problem of mixing up the castes, the classes in the units. Having created this sort of class company situation, but then you get into World War II and you're getting losses, you have different troops coming in. And I want to kind of give you, it's a little bit technical, but it's an example from a machine gun battalion. And they originally had sort of four companies. They had Rangars, Punjabi Muslims, and then two companies of Hindu Jats. But then they're changed into a new formation with mortars and machine guns, and they're only going to have three companies. So the officers are like, oh my God, how do we keep everyone separate? How do we take the same troops and divide them up so that they're on their own units? And what they eventually come to is they have two units, one that is all Muslim company and one all Hindu Jat company. But then the third company, they mix Muslims and Hindu Jats together, two different kinds of Muslim classes and Hindu Jats together, and they call it the Chapati Company, right? And then this, the officer in charge of it, this Peter Francis, one of the characters I interviewed, he thinks it's an innovation to have three different castes in my company. In fact, this was a normal expedient throughout the Indian Army in World War II. This happened in all kinds of different ways. The Chapati Company worked fine. In fact, they were in some very sharp actions and had to do some things that earn it military respect. So there's no problem with the Chapati Company. It shows that while British officers had been indoctrinated in the principles of class division, under pressure, they rewrote the rules. British officers took for granted that Indian soldiers came in different ethnic classes, which must be kept separate and any interactions carefully regulated. It's this idea which created the problem the officers of MG 9th JAT felt they had to resolve. But when force of circumstances led to the creation of Chapati-like arrangements, class proved more flexible in practice than martial races discourse allowed. There was no necessary loss of effectiveness when class relations were changed. Now, this is not to say that you could just divide the units up any which way, or that in respect of class, anything was possible, or that class did not matter. It certainly did. Once troops were organized and recruited in this way, they had a direct investment in class relations, not least their chances for promotion and their conditions of service, as well as their continued well-being of their home communities, to which military service was a very important economic supplement. While British officers often underestimated the latitude possible in class organization, sticking to their fixed ethnic stereotypes, they were not wrong in fearing the volatility of tinkering with class. The constructed but fateful character of communal relations is something the Indian Army shared with colonized Indian society. In army and society, resistance often took ethnic form because governance managed people and their life chances through ethnic categorizations. Okay, I'm gonna turn now to some of my material on training and drill and see what's going on here. Now, drill is the central disciplinary and pedagogical technique of the modern military. It's simultaneously training, practice, and ritual. It's pervasive in all regular armies, past and present, and along with other forms of military pedagogy, such as the step-by-step manual, it is widely adaptable to different military purposes and to recruits from different social, cultural, and educational backgrounds. As Wynne Dyer comments, one of the most striking characteristics of armies is their use of rote learning and standardization. Now, you know, one problem the Indian Army confronts is Indian and African peasants unfamiliar with modern machinery. You know, many of them had to be taught to tell time. And here you can see how they've devised ways, even complete with a little L plate, to teach MT drivers. The way drill works as a training, as a pedagogy, is to break down the steps of anything you have to do into step-by-step instructions and teach it over and over and over again. This is a Gurkha mortar true. You can see he's got the round there. This is the loader. This is the gun commander. They're not actually going to shoot it. There's Auchinleck, who's a very significant figure in World War II, and a very interesting character vis-a-vis the Indian Army. A very big advocate to try and stop British officers being racist towards Indian commissioned officers in World War II. In order to fight effectively in regular warfare, soldiers have to take appropriate and correct actions, whatever they may be, in stressful and life-threatening conditions. Inculcating this ability in soldiers requires training and drill. Modern armies drill is not only for ceremonies and parade grounds, it remains the Army's indispensable pedagogy. It's correct execution necessary for combat effectiveness. Just about any action soldiers or units need to take can be broken down into steps and taught as a drill. And this produces a shared standard among trainees of differing abilities. Also, along with various teaching aids, you can provide effective instruction with a minimum of cultural and linguistic competence. Training teaches troops what to do at the appropriate shouts or prompts of command. Now, much writing about military discipline suspends drill between ritual and modernity. Obviously ritual, scholars implot drill, is a distinctive Western quality that originated in Greco-Roman antiquity. Military drill appears modern and occidental, while ritual is ordinarily associated with the pre-modern and non-West. Historically, in fact, peoples have invented and practiced drill in widely disparate times and places. The world histories of drill began in ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt and continued in China, Japan, India, and Africa, as well as in Europe. European forms of drill did become globally dominant, carried abroad with the imperial expansion or imported by rising powers. But in conceiving drill as essentially Western and modern, its cosmopolitan character risks being overlooked. For infantry soldiers in particular, Drill has an ancient heritage and ongoing histories that have always involved different peoples. Romans and Carthaginians drilled in their wars, as did British and Zulus in theirs. Drill's reach across time and place best reveals its powers rather than provincializing it in often triumphalist Western histories. Drill does not work because of special Western properties, but because of its cosmopolitan powers, because it works for nearly anybody. There you can see the trio of weapons again. This time, it's a Lewis gun. It's a World War I era gun that was given to the Indian Army, or the Indian Army still had early in World War II. They would always have knockoff weapons that would be the last to modernize. Now, I just want to pick out a problem that instructors confronted in training infantry for Burma. And this is the fire discipline problem. Fire discipline is a kind of common thing that you have to teach all infantry. It involves holding your fire, marking your targets, and using your ammunition carefully. In Burma, it's extremely important, partly because it's very difficult to get ammunition out to Burma, so they don't want people using it up, which modern automatic weapons will use a lot of it very quickly. But more important, a lot of the fighting takes place at night, and the way you attack a position in Burma, which are usually all-round defended perimeters, is you've got to figure out where the firing positions are. These would often be camouflaged, put trees over it, and so on, and the attacking force wants to locate these guys. And so the Japanese developed a whole bunch of tactics that they called jittering tactics. You know, how it is you cat calls out from the jungle, throwing things, shouting in Urdu, all kinds of things to try and make the guys open fire at night. And one of the things that would happen in untrained battalions in Burma is they would do a lot of shooting at night off into the blackness. Because when you're scared shitless, sitting in a trench in Burma, thinking the Japanese might be out there going to bayonet you or whatever, shooting your weapon makes you feel good, right? But that's not what you should be doing. In fact, if you shoot your weapon and you don't know what you're shooting at, you may, in fact, be opening yourself up to attack. So the instructors have to figure out a way to do this, to teach this to troops. And what they would do is they would take the Indian soldiers, they would put them in a trench like this. They would give them 5 rounds of ammunition. And they would tell them that the exercise is going to go on for at least 2 hours. And then mock Japanese soldiers would start coming out of the jungle to assault the position. And of course, the trainees would shoot their ammunition up really quickly. And they would be left without ammunition. And there would be the Japanese soldiers. At this point, the instructors would come out. Sometimes they would dress themselves in the uniform of a Japanese officer. And sometimes they would dress the Indians in saris. They put the women's clothes on them, right? You can see that they're kind of playing on a kind of militarized masculinity as a common cultural resource to connect with the Indians. And there's sort of obvious sexual metaphors in fire discipline, or would have appeared that way to the British officers holding your fire to the right moment, that a real man holds his fire to the right moment. And this is the language that they would use to harangue the soldiers. You know, your children, we're playing a real war out here. You should go home to your mothers. Or you're women, you can't control yourselves, or this kind of thing, right? What I like about this little story it was a regular exercise in an advanced infantry course, is that ask yourself, is it the saris that is really significant in this story? Is it the deployment of these kind of ham-fisted cultural competencies that the British trainers had? Or is it the way in which the exercise simulates the structure of the battlefield and a situation in which you don't need a huge amount of imagination to figure out what's going to happen to you if you shoot up all your ammunition too quickly in the actual circumstances, right? So it's one of the ways in which you're able to get across the lessons you need to get across, but without really knowing much about the culture, language, politics, all the rest of the people that you're training. And I would suggest to you that this goes on a lot. This is what military cross-cultural or multicultural military training looks like. Okay, let me just catch up. Now, you could teach the same exercise to British troops. There's a infantry fighting position, this time with Royal Welsh Fusiliers. If you had a field craft exercise for British troops, you could call it Cops and Robbers. The same exercise for Indians is called Tiger Hunt, right? It, it's in the structure of what they're teaching you, not the cultural appropriateness of what they're doing. Okay, I've made that point. All right, I want to draw one further point of the fire control out of the fire control example. It begins to demonstrate what I call the harsh structure of combat. Too much writing on combat motivation emphasizes the notion of fighting spirit, whether derived from ideology, nationalism, esprit de corps, or their combination. This portrays the battlefield as a domain of agency, expressive of the individual and collective character of soldiers and their units. They kill and die in accordance with their national styles. But battlefields are in fact sites of extreme constraint. They thrust harsh choices upon combatants. Combat is reciprocal, tit for tat. Variable patterns evolve which ensnare both sides and govern their behavior. Ideology may initiate the intense fighting of race war, but once in motion, it requires neither racist nor heroic soldiers to sustain it. The interaction of opposing forces forms a structure of battle that confronts soldiers and their units as an external reality, the rules of a game already underway. For those involved, apparently extreme reactions like combat suicide or fighting to the last man, last round, can be reasonable responses to the situation. Indeed, such responses were often shared across the lines. From different nations and different armies, soldiers acted in comparable ways when caught in similar straits during the Burma campaign. Combat is no respecter of nations. Okay. I'm not going to go through all this material, but the next set of material is on the ritual dimensions of military training, and in particular, well, there are two things I really go after here in this part of the book. One of them is a kind of basic insight from ritual theory, which is that, you know, rituals create groups. Groups don't have rituals. That ritual is about something that simply participating in it, rather than decoding its particular meanings, generates forms of solidarity. You know, as Catherine Bell puts it, ritual systems do not function to regulate or control some prior social order. They are the system. So what I offer in the book is a kind of Durkheimian reading of military group solidarity, of military ritual as forming group solidarity and as inculcating hierarchy in military units. But I also do one other thing. In military sociology, one of the principal debates, sort of presumptions of all the debates they have about combat motivation, is the notion that casualties are corrosive of cohesion or fighting spirit, right? So the idea is that a primary group will break down once a certain number of buddies are killed. Or as Omar Bartov says in his devastating critique of the primary group theorists, that if combat is really intense and people are being killed off very rapidly, how is it that your buddies support you? What is supporting you, Bartov argues, is ideological fanaticism. His case is German soldiers on the Eastern Front. What I argue in the book is this, you know, as it were, ignores the central insight of the study of sacrifice in anthropology. Sacrifice is about generating cohesion and solidarity amongst the group, amongst the living and the dead. And if military units can be conceived in this kind of a way, in which casualties ideologically reinforce the solidarity of the remaining soldiers, and if that's happening on both sides of a battle, you get a kind of ideological source, a cycle of blood debt that doesn't require politics, that doesn't require something outside the system to keep it going. There may well be also nationalism, ideological fanaticism, racism, all kinds of other things. But there is a facility that the military has itself with this ritualized training and cycle of blood debt that can generate a will to combat. So to conclude, the Indian Army and other British Imperial forces were part of the globalization of Western forms of military discipline. What made the Army globalizable was its cosmopolitan character and its adaptability of its sturdy and robust techniques to different social and political contexts. Many armed forces today began their institutional histories in colonial contexts or under imperial tutelage. The Kenyan Army was formed out of the King's African Rifles. The Nigerian Army started as the Royal West African Frontier Force. The story is similar for much of former French Africa and the successor states to the British Raj in South Asia and elsewhere. Other armies have mixed or informal imperial parentage. The South Korean Army and National Police began in Japanese imperial service and then developed into national armed forces in the late 1940s under American occupation. The US has trained, advised, and supported Latin and Central American armies and other security forces for over a century. Armies may appear to be the principal national, even nationalist, institution, but their histories are very often imperial and global in one way or another. The cosmopolitanism of the regular army made possible these histories, arraying brown and black men in disciplined order to kill and violently repress other brown and black people was central to the making of the modern world.